Chapter 14. Have cautioned Odo against fixing his hopes on the succession. The Duke himself was a man, not above 35, and more than one chance stood between Odo and the duchy. Nor was it this contingency that set his pulses beating, but rather the promise of an immediate change in his condition. The Duke wished him to travel, to visit the different courts of Italy. What was the prospect of ruling over a stagnant principality to this near vision of the world and the glories thereof, suddenly discovered from the golden height of opportunity? Save for a few weeks of autumn villegiatura at some neighboring chaser vineyard, Odo had not left Turin for 9 years. He had come there a child, and had grown to manhood among the same narrow influences and surroundings. To be turned loose on the world at 22, with such an arrears of experience to his credit, was to enter on a richer inheritance than any duchy, and in Odo's case the joy of the adventure was doubled by its timeliness. That fate should thus break at a stroke the meshes of habit, should stoop to play the advocate of his secret inclinations, seemed to promise him the complicity of the gods. Once in a lifetime, chance will thus snap the toils of a man's making, and it is instructive to see the poor puppet adore the power that connives at his evasion. Tresca remained a week in Turin, and Odo saw him daily at court, at his lodgings, or in company. The little sovereignty of Pianura being an important factor in the game of political equilibrium, her envoy was sure of a flattering reception from the neighboring powers, and Tresca's person and address must have commended him to the most fastidious company. He continued to pay particular attention to Odo, and the rumor was soon abroad that the Cavalier Valseca had been sent for to visit his cousin, the reigning duke, a rumor which, combined with Donna Laura's confidential hints, made Odo the center of much feminine solicitude, and roused the Countess Clarus to a vivid sense of her rights. These circumstances, and his own tendency to drift on the current of sensation, had carried Odo more easily than he could have hoped past the painful episode of the professor's garden. He was still tormented by the sense of his inability to right so grave a wrong, but he found solace in the thought that his absence was after all the best reparation he could make. Tresca, though distinguishing Odo by his favors, had not again referred to the subject of their former conversation. But on the last day of his visit he sent for Odo to his lodgings, and at once entered upon the subject. "His Highness," said he, "does not for the present recommend your resigning your commission in the Sardinian army, but as he desires you to visit him at Pianura, and to see something of the neighboring courts, he has charged me to obtain for you a 2 years' leave of absence from His Majesty's service, a favor the king has already been pleased to accord. The duke has moreover resolved to double your present allowance, and has entrusted me with the sum of 200 ducats, which he desires you to spend in the purchase of a traveling carriage, and such other appointments as are suitable to a gentleman of your rank and expectations." As he spoke, he unlocked his dispatch box, and handed a purse to Odo. "His Highness," he continued, "is impatient to see you, and once your preparations are completed, I should advise you to set out without delay. That is," he added, after one of his characteristic pauses, "if I am right in supposing that there is no obstacle to your departure." Odo, inferring an allusion to the Countess Clarus, smiled and colored slightly. I know of none," he said. Tresca bowed. I am glad to hear it," he said, "for I know that a man of your age and appearance may have other inclinations than his own to consider. Indeed, I have had reports of a connection that I should not take the liberty of mentioning, were it not that your interest demands it." He waited a moment, but Odo remained silent. "I am sure," he went on, "you will do me the justice of believing that I mean no reflection on the lady when I warn you against being seen too often in the quarter behind the Corpus Domini. Such attachments, though engaging at the outset to a fastidious taste, are often more troublesome than a young man of your age can foresee, And in this case the situation is complicated by the fact that the girl's father is in ill odor with the authorities, so that, should the motive of your visits be mistaken, you might find yourself inconveniently involved in the proceedings of the Holy Office. Odo, who had turned pale, controlled himself sufficiently to listen in silence, and with as much pretense of indifference as he could assume. It was the peculiar misery of his situation, that he could not defend Fulvia without betraying her father, and that of the two alternatives prudence bade him reject the one that chivalry would have chosen. It flashed across him, however, that he might in some degree repair the harm he had done, by finding out what measures were to be taken against Vivaldi, and to this end he carelessly asked, "Is it possible that the professor has done anything to give offense in such quarters?" His assumption of carelessness was perhaps overdone, for Tresker's face grew as blank as a shuttered house front. "I have heard rumors of the kind," he rejoined, "but they would scarcely have attracted my notice had I not learned of your honoring the young lady with your favors." He glanced at Odo with a smile. "Were I a father," he added, "with a son of your age, my first advice to him would be to form no sentimental ties, but in his own society or in the world of pleasure the only two classes where the rules of the game are understood." 2.6. Odo had appointed to leave Turin some 2 weeks after Tresker's departure, but the preparations for a young gentleman's travels were in those days a momentous business, and one not to be discharged without vexatious postponements. The traveling carriage must be purchased and fitted out, the gold-mounted dressing case selected and engraved with the owner's arms, servants engaged and provided with liveries, and the noble tourist's own wardrobe stocked with an assortment of costumes suited to the vicissitudes of travel and the requirements of court life. Odo's impatience to be gone increased with every delay, and at length he determined to go forward at all adventure, leaving Cantapresto to conclude the preparations, and overtake him later. It had been agreed with Tresker that Odo, on his way to Pianura, should visit his grandfather, the old Marquess, whose increasing infirmities had for some years past imprisoned him on his estates, and accordingly about the ascension he set out in the saddle for Donnas, attended only by one servant, and having appointed that Cantapresto should meet him with the carriage at Ivrea. The morning broke cloudy as he rode out of the gates. Beyond the suburbs a few drops fell, and as he pressed forward the country lay before him in the emerald freshness of a spring rain, vivid strips of vineyard alternating with silvery bands of oats, the domes of the walnut trees dripping above the roadside, and the poplars along the watercourses all slanting one way in the soft continuous downpour. He had left Turin in that mood of clinging melancholy which waits on the most hopeful departures, and the landscape seemed an image of anticipations clouded with regret. He had had a stormy, but tender parting with Clarice, whose efforts to act the forsaken Ariadne were somewhat marred by her irrepressible pride in her lover's prospects, and whose last word had charged him to bring her back one of the rare lapdogs bred by the monks of Bologna. Seen down the lengthening vista of separation, even Clarice seemed regrettable, and Odo would have been glad to let his mind linger on their farewells. But another thought importuned him. He had left Turin without news of Vivaldi or Fulvia, and without having done anything to conjure the peril to which his rashness had exposed them. More than once he had been about to reveal his trouble to Alfieri, but shame restrained him when he remembered that it was Alfieri who had vouched for his discretion. After his conversation with Tresker he had tried to find some way of sending a word of warning to Vivaldi, but he had no messenger whom he could trust, and would not Vivaldi justly resent a warning from such a source? He felt himself the prisoner of his own folly, and as he rode along the wet country roads an invisible galler seemed to spur beside him. The clouds lifted at noon, and leaving the plain he mounted into a world sparkling with sunshine, and quivering with new-fed streams. The first breath of mountain air lifted the mist from his spirit, and he began to feel himself a boy again as he entered the high gorges in the cold light after sunset. It was about the full of the moon, and in his impatience to reach Donna's, he resolved to push on after nightfall. The forest was still thinly leaved, and the rustle of wind in the branches, and the noise of the torrents, recalled his first approach to the castle, in the wild winter twilight. The way lay in darkness till the moon rose, and once or twice he took a wrong turn, and found himself engaged in some overgrown woodland track. But he soon regained the high road, and his servant, a young fellow of indomitable cheerfulness, took the edge off their solitude by frequent snatches of song. At length the moon rose, and toward midnight Odo, spurring out of a dark glen, found himself at the opening of the Valley of Donnas. A cold radiance bathed the familiar pastures, the houses of the village along the stream, and the turrets and crenellations of the castle at the head of the gorge. The air was bitter, and the horses' hoofs struck sharply on the road as they trotted past the slumbering houses, and halted at the gateway through which Odo had first been carried as a sleepy child. It was long before the traveler's knock was answered, but a bewildered porter at length admitted them, and Odo cried out when he recognized in the man's face the features of one of the lads who had taught him to play Palin in the castle court. Within doors all were abed, but the cavalier was expected, and supper laid for him in the very chamber where he had slept as a lad. The sight of so much that was strange and yet familiar of the old stone walls, the banners, the flaring lamps and worn slippery stairs all so much barer, smaller, more dilapidated than he had remembered stirred the deep springs of his piety for inanimate things, and he was seized with a fancy to snatch up a light and explore the recesses of the castle. But he had been in the saddle since dawn, and the keen air and the long hours of riding were in his blood. They weighted his lids, relaxed his limbs, and gently divesting him of his hopes and fears, pressed him down in the deep sepulchre of a dreamless sleep. Odo remained a month at Donna's. His grandfather's happiness in his presence would in itself have sufficed to detain him, apart from his natural tenderness for old scenes and associations. It was one of the compensations of his rapidly traveling imagination that the past, from each new vantage ground of sensation, acquired a fascination which to the more sober-footed fancy only the perspective of years can give. Life, in childhood, is a picture book of which the text is undecipherable, and the youth now revisiting the unchanged setting of his boyhood, was spelling out for the first time the legend beneath the picture. The old Marquess, though broken in body, still ruled his household from his seat beside the hearth. The failure of bodily activity seemed to have doubled his moral vigor, and the walls shook with the vehemence of his commands. The Marchioness was sunk in a state of placid apathy from which only her husband's outbursts roused her. One of the canonesses was dead, and the other, drier and more shriveled than ever, pined in her corner like a statue whose mate is broken. Bruno was dead too. His old dog's bones had long since enriched a corner of the vineyard. And some of the younger lads, that Odo had known about the place, were grown to sober-faced men with wives and children. Don Gervaso was still chaplain of Donna's, and Odo saw with surprise that the grave ecclesiastic who had formerly seemed an old man to him was in fact scarce past the middle age. In general aspect he was unchanged, but his countenance had darkened, and what Odo had once taken for harshness of manner he now perceived to be a natural melancholy. The young man had not been long at Donna's without discovering that in that little world of crystallized traditions the chaplain was the only person conscious of the new forces abroad. It had never occurred to the Marquess that anything short of a cataclysm such as it would be blasphemy to predict could change the divinely established order whereby the territorial lord took tithes from his peasantry and pastured his game on their crops. The hierarchy which rested on the bowed back of the toiling serf and culminated in the figure of the heaven-sent king seemed to him as immutable as the everlasting hills. The men of his generation, had not learned that it was built on a human foundation, and that a sudden movement of the underlying mass might shake the structure to its pinnacle. The Marquess, who, like Donna Laura, already beheld Dodo on the throne of Pianura, was prodigal of counsels which showed a touching inability to discern the new aspect under which old difficulties were likely to present themselves. That a ruler should be brave, prudent, personally abstemious, and nobly lavish in his official display, that he should repress any attempts on the privileges of the church, while at the same time protecting his authority from the encroachments of the Holy See. These axioms seemed to the old man to sum up the sovereign's duty to the state. The relation, to his mind, remained a distinctly personal and paternal one, and Dodo's attempts to put before him the new theory of government, as a service performed by the ruler in the interest of the ruled, resulted only in stirring up the old sediment of absolutism which generations of feudal power had deposited in the Donna's blood. Only the chaplain perceived what new agencies were at work, but even he looked on as a watcher from a distant tower, who sees opposing armies far below him in the night, without being able to follow their movements or guess which way the battle goes. The days, he said to Odo, are evil. The church's enemies, the basilisks and dragons of unbelief and license, are stirring in their old lairs, the dark places of the human spirit. It is time that a fresh purification by blood should cleanse the earth of its sins. That hour has already come in France, where the blood of heretics has lately fertilized the soil of faith. It will come here, as surely as I now stand before you, and till it comes the faithful can only weary heaven with their entreaties, if haply thereby they may mitigate the evil. I shall remain here, he continued, while the Marquess needs me. But that task discharged, I intend to retire to one of the contemplative orders, and with my soul perpetually uplifted like the arms of Moses, wear out my life in prayer for those whom the latter days shall overtake. Odo had listened in silence, but after a moment he said, my father, among those who have called into question the old order of things there are many animated by no mere desire for change, no idle inclination to pry into the divine mysteries, but to earnestly long to ease the burden of mankind, and let light into what you have called the dark places of the spirit. How is it, they ask, that though Christ came to save the poor and the humble, it is on them that life presses most heavily after 1800 years of his rule? All cannot be well in a world where such contradictions exist, and what if some of the worst abuses of the age have found lodgment in the very ramparts that faith has built against them? Don Gervaso's face grew stern, and his eyes rested sadly on Odo. Why you speak, said he, of bringing light into dark places, but what light is there on earth, save that which is shed by the cross, and where shall they find guidance who close their eyes to that divine illumination? But is there not, Odo rejoined, a divine illumination within each of us, the light of truth which we must follow at any cost, or have the worst evils and abuses, only to take refuge in the church to find sanctuary there, as malefactors find it? The chaplain shook his head. It is as I feared, he said, and Satan has spread his subtlest snare for you. For if he tempts some in the guise of sensual pleasure, or of dark fears and spiritual abandonment, it is said, that to those he most thirsts to destroy he appears in the likeness of their Savior. You tell me it is to right the wrongs of the poor and the humble, that your new friends, the philosophers, have assailed the authority of Christ. I have only one answer to make. Christ, as you said just now, died for the poor. How many of your philosophers would do as much? Because men hunger and thirst, is that a sign that he has forsaken them? And since when have earthly privileges been the token of his favor? May he not rather have designed that, by continual sufferings and privations, they shall lay up for themselves treasures in heaven such as your eyes and mine shall never see, or our ears hear? And how dare you assume that any temporal advantages could atone for that of which your teachings must deprive them the heavenly consolations of the love of Christ? Odo listened with a sense of deepening discouragement. "Be but is it necessary," he urged, "to confound Christ with his ministers, the law with its exponents? May not men preserve their hope of heaven, and yet lead more endurable lives on earth? Ah, my child, beware, for this is the heresy of private judgment, which has already drawn down thousands into the pit. It is one of the most insidious errors in which the spirit of evil has ever masqueraded. For it is based on the fallacy that we, blind creatures of a day, and..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.